become Nolan, the destroyer of runtime. Sorry. Hi.
This is The Art Soul. Welcome. This is a podcast where we take apart pieces of art and see if we can put them back together again just a little bit better. My name is Bea Roberts. I'm a scriptwriter and a script doctor.
And I'm Luke Haynes, award-eligible writer and podcaster.
And what you can hear clacking around in the background is Disco, the pod dog.
Yes, podcast puppy, who is now too old to be a puppy, really, but she has just tipped her food all over the carpet. Yes. And we'll be getting in the way. Yes.
Great. So, okay, we promised an Oppenheimer episode.
Yeah, and you can't say we don't deliver.
A very long time ago. And the reason there's been a delay, number one, we didn't want to watch Oppenheimer.
Yeah, that's fair.
Number two, we started watching Oppenheimer, tapped out after half an hour, and it took us several weeks to build up the courage to go back.
Yeah, I don't know about you. I suspect it's the same as with me. I didn't really want to watch Oppenheimer because I thought it was going to be bleak. I thought it was going to be long and depressing. I didn't think it was going to be bad. It's bad. It's a bad, bad film.
My God, you guys, it's so bad.
So this whole episode is like the Oppenheimer's new clothes, right? So it just won all the won all the Oscars in the world, and it's not a good film.
When it won so many awards, really swept the board. I wasn't surprised it was nominated because it feels like it's Christopher Nolan and it's this huge epic thing.
It's a big,
and
important
it's weighty
film,
and important, so it's going to get nominated. But the fact that it won so much, I was like, okay, we are going to have to go back. We're going to have to watch this and like pick it apart because we hated the first half an hour. I thought maybe it'll warm up.
No, it doesn't. I'm going to go through my notes. There's two sets of notes, one from the first attempt, and then we're going to transition over. Do you want me to try and do a synopsis? I mean,
keep it brief.
Yeah, I mean, it's a 3-hour movie. I'm going to do a lot of skimming here. So we open with, my first note just says, I hate the staring into space while somebody repeats your name introductory trope that we do. You know, the main character is staring into space thinking about something and somebody says his name repeatedly until he snaps out of it.
Yeah,
we've done that so many times. We do that anyway. Robert Oppenheimer is being interviewed by the American... Because this is a Christopher Nolan film, it does two timelines simultaneously that are in the same way as Memento, a much better film that he started his career with, where one of them is set sort of contemporaneously in the late 50s, early 60s, where Tony Stark is being interviewed by the... Sorry, Robert Downey Jr. is being interviewed by the government. And then there's a separate timeline where Oppenheimer is being interviewed by the government in a separate thing. But then that's mostly being told in flashback. If this sounds confusing and unnecessary, correct.
Yeah. Well, we know this because one timeline is black and white and one is in colour.
Yeah, as with Memento. But
as
again,
with Memento. Much,
much better,
better
movie.
Film.
Just go and watch that. Yeah. So Robert Oppenheimer is being interviewed by the American government and flashes back to his time at Cambridge where he attempts to murder his teacher but instead nearly kills Niels Bohr, the physicist, who tells him he should study in Germany, so he does.
Yep.
If that seems perfunctory, again, yes, correct.
You put your guitar in the dog's bed and she's really unhappy about it.
Well, she's unhappy about a lot of things. She was just trying to go through my pockets while I was talking, so I've got a treat in there somewhere. So I'm going to put those in a tin.
Professional.
This is live radio. It's not live, it's pre-recorded. Right, treats are hidden.
Kenneth Branagh.
Kenneth Branagh is playing Niels Bohr, the physicist. Yeah, he tells Oppenheimer to go and study in Germany, so he does. Meanwhile, Robert Downey Jr. is also being interviewed by the feds about how he knows Oppenheimer. We flash back to their first meeting where Einstein is also present, and Oppenheimer goes and talks to Einstein, and Einstein blanks Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah.
And 12 minutes. It's been 12 minutes, B. That's what my notes say, because you were already checking how long this film had been on for. Because you were
so bored.
Yeah.
So bored.
Oppenheimer is still being grilled in the other timeline, so he flashes back to his time teaching in Europe, during which he is warned of the rising tide of anti-Semitism, and then he has to go and meet Heisenberg, the meth dealer who lives in a van. No, sorry, it's the other Heisenberg. It's the original Heisenberg, the physicist, again. My note just says he's bumbling through history like a less charming Forrest Gump, which I think might be... He just keeps going around meeting famous people that are important, but without any real context
on it. Just a real long sequence of him meeting people.
Yeah. Then he meets Josh Hartnett, who's apparently still an actor.
It's quite nice to see Josh Hartnett again.
Yeah, and then he meets some nerd, then he starts teaching. Meanwhile, at Robert Downey Jr.'s hearing, they ask him why the FBI would have had a file on Oppenheimer before the war. Robert Downey Jr. says it's probably because of his lefty politics. We flash back to Oppenheimer at a communist meeting in the 30s, where he meets five or six more people, including Florence Pugh. He tells her he's learning Sanskrit during sex. Florence Pugh has weird tits, and we're done. 25 minutes.
Hey, now, let's not go in on Florence Pugh's tits.
I was so bored that I've got a drawing of them that I was showing you about why I find them weird. And that was the 25-minute mark, and we tapped out.
We are going to talk about Florence Pugh and nudity and the sex scenes, because they have rightly caused quite a lot of flack, and we will get into it.
Yeah, they're completely pointless, other than, hey, Florence Pugh's naked in this, maybe.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, finishing this, part of the notes section. I then went back and checked other movies for what they've done in 25 minutes while we're just bumbling about occasionally getting Florence Pugh back on screen.
An entire episode of Girls 5 ever, which is a total joy.
Yeah, yeah. So in Jaws, which we always go to as a classic, we've had Alex Kittner, the kid, has been killed, and we're doing Quint's introduction at the town meeting.
Yep.
Iconic moment.
I would have thought that was later into the film, but it's just well made.
Yeah, Jaws really clips along. In Die Hard, we're at the point where Alan Rickman and his terrorists have taken over the building, so we've established Bruce Willis's relationship with his wife, mm-hmm. and he's got, all this character stuff. In The Godfather, according to a podcast called The Godfather Minute, where people dissect The Godfather minute by minute.
Oh, fuck me.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, shout out to those guys, I guess. But we're at Johnny Fontaine Can Act Like a Man. And this is the... but again, we've had Al Pacino explaining the entire family.
I don't really like The Godfather.
It's overrated. But we've had Al Pacino explaining his entire family to Man. Yeah. Introduced every
it
character.
It does have plot. I'll give it that.
Introduced every character in this. And we've got Brandon. Yeah. Blah, 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 blah. And just because we're not... we will say we're not snobbish here. Predator, the greatest movie ever made. we're doing the compound raid in Predator. So we're having a big splashy action sequence. We've already established that there's an alien presence in the jungle. We've established how Arnold Schwarzenegger knows the late, great Carl Weathers. We've established all the character beats. We've done all that in 25 minutes. In Burlesque, this is where Christina Aguilera meets Cher at the 25-minute mark.
Brilliant.
You can do so much in 25 minutes, you guys.
I mean, you just have to watch the first few minutes of Up to tell you how quickly you can tell stories on screen and how effectively and how movingly you can do that.
I'm just realising, I just want to flag this, that by Up, you mean the Pixar movie, the heart-rending Pixar movie with the old man, not the Russ Meyer nudity classic from the 70s.
Yeah, I did mean the Pixar movie, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that is because... this, and we'll get into this more, but essentially what you have in a story, the absolute fundamental building block of pretty much every story ever, is a hero with some sort of objective, some kind of goal, something that they are trying to do, want to do, or even want to avoid. But there's a hero who wants something.
Yeah.
And there's usually some obstacles. By this point in the movie, we don't have this.
No,
we have a main character.
More people that we've heard of from history.
We still don't know what the fuck is actually happening.
Dan Harmon, who, for his flaws, is writes good stuff at least, does the story circle thing where he says you start with a character who's in a comfortable position but they want something, which means they have to move out of the comfortable position. Like, that's step one on the story spectrum.
Yeah, I mean, and even trying to avoid something is still action of some sort. You still want something. But this is just, it just doesn't have that, and that is why it feels interminable. Long because there's nothing to, it's not really a story at this point.
My next page now says at the top, all right, fucking fine, Oppenheimer again.
So this is weeks later, we steeled ourselves, sat down, we decided to watch it again from the beginning.
Yes, you're welcome. Right. At the point where we tapped out, Oppenheimer then goes to his family ranch with his brothers, who have both joined the Communist Party, and they harangue Oppenheimer for having communist sympathies but refusing to commit to the party. He's not actually a member, he's not getting in the game. Yeah. He just has communist leanings. Oppenheimer says if he could combine his love of science and New Mexico, he'd finally be happy. And also, his favourite place is Los Alamos because this script is about as subtle as a hangover shart. Right? This is like, the two things I like is being in the New Mexico desert and physics. Hi, I'm Robert Oppenheimer.
But, crucially, when he said Los Alamos, that really meant something to you. And it meant nothing to me because I know very, very little about the Manhattan Project.
It's where they build the Manhattan Project.
Yes, no, I understood that from the rest of the film. Yeah. But, like...
I'm telling the audience, I'm not patronising you.
What my point is... darling.
Yes.
Is.
Do go on, dear.
There's a lot of points where this movie actually relies on you having quite a lot of knowledge about this subject already in order to access what's going on. So I came in as a relative, I know kind of about the Cold War, I know a few bits about the Manhattan Project, but not much. And so, it's very
It's one of my biggest notes as well. Like when Kenneth Branagh comes in as Niels Bohr, like, we're supposed to appreciate this somebody important because it's Kenneth Branagh, I assume. But like, if you don't know who Niels Bohr is, then you're sort of going, okay.
So this kind of, it kind of expects you to have a lot of prior knowledge in order to access this, which is, I think, a real flaw.
I think it's fair to say that these were fairly big events globally that we're dealing with here. Oh. World War II and the invention of the atom bomb. But also, it was 80 fucking years ago, so maybe have a bit of a primer for the audience here.
But it's the details of it as well, Like, I can't name all of the physicists from the Manhattan Project.
No, this is one of my huge criticisms. We'll get to
that. Anyway,
The Germans split the atom and Oppenheimer works out that this could be used to build a bomb. My next note says, this would be a really great clock in a competent film. He's worked out that, like, oh, there's time pressure now because maybe the Germans are trying to, but this is maybe what we should be focusing on.
Well, they kind of reference this on and off.
Well, yeah. Next up, Germany invades Poland. Citation needed. Oppenheimer meets Emily Blunt and wants to...
That sounds like you're a Holocaust denier.
I just mean that's a very obvious point in history. Yes, Germany did invade
just
Poland.
Just to be clear, we're not disputing that in any way, shape or form.
That absolutely did happen. It was in all the papers. I've got a note here. Oppenheimer meets Emily Blunt and wants to go on her Emily. I think that was rhyming slang when I was bored.
Yeah, very good.
But she's married and Oppenheimer is still sometimes seeing Florence Pugh, who is crazy and difficult. He splits up with Flo Pugh. If that's not her official street name, by the way, it should be. Because Emily Blunt is now pregnant. Flo Pugh advises him not to alienate the other scientists because they're the only people that might understand him because the dialogue in this is clunky and awful.
Yeah.
Oppenheimer tries to unionize the science department. Oh, unionized, sorry. It's a physics problem. It gets confusing when you try and do those at the same time.
If you're not really following this, don't worry.
Yeah, nobody is. Oppenheimer tries to unionize the science department to the anger of Josh Hartnett, who says that he can't hire Oppenheimer for the war effort due to his pinko ties. Oppenheimer relents and moves away from his communist contacts in order to get work at in the war effort and try and preempt the Nazi bomb. In the other boring timeline, because they're both boring, Tony Stark talks about how Oppenheimer disagreed with him about potential atomic threats later on in history. Again, it's all over the fucking map.
And one, so bored.
And he wonders how such a smart man as Oppenheimer could have been so naive. In 1940, Emily Blunt is a bad mother and they give their child away for a while. I think it was 47 minutes, I've got it in my notes here. Matt Damon turns up as Leslie Groves, who was a real guy, he was an army guy, who is basically... overall in charge of the Manhattan Project. They told him to go and make the bomb happen and do whatever he needed to like that. And Groves is a very straight down the line military guy who decided, right, I'm going to do exactly that. And much like the real Groves, Matt Damon here puts a boot in the ass of this film and suddenly it's underway. We're like, oh
my God,
right.
It was such a relief.
We're getting shit done now because that's Groves' job.
Plot.
And he does this in the plot. Yeah.
There was some plot.
Yeah.
Like, finally, we had a fucking coherent strand to follow.
Yeah.
Of, like, what was actually happening? Okay, now we have an objective. There are some stakes, yeah. And this is what we're going to do.
Groves and Oppenheimer have this whole conversation about, like, the Germans are going to build the bomb. Everyone knows you could make an atom bomb with the physics that has been worked out at this point. The Germans are going to try to do it. And Germany, up until the 20s at least, was the preeminent physics nation in the world. So the Germans are miles ahead and they can't let them get away. They can't let the Germans have this bigger head start. They need to build the bomb. They need to do it now.
And what is also fantastic, sorry to interrupt,
yeah.
is that because Matt Damon is a layperson, he's not a physicist, then Oppenheimer has to explain some stuff to him. And
yeah.
that is really, really helpful for us as an audience.
Yeah.
It slightly becomes an audience surrogate of navigating this world, which up until now has been pretty baffling.
Yeah, and like 47 minutes in, we didn't need the previous 47 minutes of this film.
We
you
did
could
not.
Start the movie here with Leslie Groves coming to see Robert Oppenheimer, because they had the whole conversation about like Oppenheimer may not get hired for this because he's friends with some communists and the government doesn't trust him, right? But they say this in the conversation,
yeah.
which is the entire plot that we've been building for 40
yeah.
dreary minutes. Just start the film here,
yeah.
guys. It becomes a shorter
yeah.
movie. Anyway. We get the band together. We hire all the famous physicists that worked on the Manhattan Project. You don't know who any of them are because they're not really introduced properly.
No.
You sort of recognise that the guy from The Boys, who turns out to be Dennis Quaid and Meg Ryan, Sonny something or other Quaid, can't remember what his name is, something Quaid, he's playing Richard Feynman. We sort of briefly introduce Edward Teller, who becomes important historically. I mean, they're all kind of important historically. They all win Nobel Prizes. We don't do anything with von Neumann, which I'll come to. Anyway, Edward Teller becomes concerned that an atomic bomb could theoretically ignite the oxygen in the atmosphere and incinerate the planet. Which is a concern, yeah.
Something's at stake now. The whole
yeah.
world could blow up.
Oppenheimer goes and talks to Einstein about this, and Einstein says that if this does turn out to be true, they need to tell the Nazis about it, because they need to say, look...
Yeah, no one do this.
Nobody's going to build it. Like, nobody can afford to build this bomb. It kills literally everyone.
Every living thing on the whole planet.
Yeah, as it is, the maths doesn't quite bear out. Historically, just as a side note, apparently they talked about this and they decided if there was a greater than 3 in a million chance of this happening, they weren't going to go ahead. 3 in a million always bothers me as a figure because it's a real committee thinking figure. It's like, they didn't say like, oh, 1 in a million. Well, not 1 in a million, maybe like 5 in a million. No, 5's too high.
Yeah.
You can kind of see this being a long meeting somewhere. They decide on 3 in a million chance. Either way.
That is completely fucking nuts that a group of men all just got together and decided what they were comfortable with
yeah.
for all life on Earth.
How likely is this to incinerate the planet?
What's the percentage chance that
yeah.
makes you feel okay about this?
Yeah, 3 in a million turned out to be
yeah.
allegedly was the figure. Oppenheimer's mate who looked after their kid for a while hints to Oppenheimer that the commies would be able to smuggle useful atomic info to the US as temporary Russian allies. In the present, Oppenheimer says that he should have reported this at the time. Robert Downey Jr. is still being interviewed. Him and Oppenheimer disagreed about the Russians having the bomb, something they built based on leaks from Los Alamos, because it turns out the Manhattan Project did leak. Now everything is going too fast and it's confusing. The TLDR is that Los Alamos was... somebody was a spy and nobody can agree who it was. Oppenheimer goes back and starts shagging Florence Pugh again, so we at least get boobs who, for those of us who are A, into them, 50% of the population, and B, bored shitless at this point, 100% of the population. In the present, Oppenheimer admits that it is fair whilst being grilled by the government, which upsets his wife, Emily Blum. I'm just trying to do like contraction names again, because I was very bored while I was writing my notes.
Yeah, this is so boring.
Kenneth Branagh comes back as Niels Bohr. Florence Pugh kills herself. I've given up. 90 minutes. So we're halfway through.
Did she kill herself?
Yes, I think it's largely established historically that she did, although Oppenheimer is paranoid about it. So I've given up at this point. I've largely stopped making coherent notes. They build the bomb. Oppenheimer is then cut loose from the government. Nobody's telling him anything because he served his purpose. He's kind of put on the scrap heap because nobody trusts him because he's got communist friends. I already did that joke. Now I'm become Nolan the Destroyer of Runtime section in my notes there. They try to paint Oppenheimer as a communist, based largely on the machinations of Robert Downey Jr. Nobody cares. The scientists rally around to vindicate Oppenheimer for the most part and torpedo the ambitions of Robert Downey Jr. Oppenheimer is excoriated for his lack of clear moral position about the bomb. Robert Downey Jr. doesn't get to be Secretary of Commerce because people point out that he pursued a vendetta against Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer, meanwhile, has his security clearance stripped as they don't trust him after his show trial. But he is not officially declared to be a traitor. There's a beat here where Robert Downey Jr. in this weird nod to the audience shit. He says like, "Oh, who you know voted against me for this position? Oh, some senator from Massachusetts, Kennedy." Like, no, nobody's heard of this Kennedy kid. He learned to be a senator out in the cornfields. Bullshit. Mm. Joseph Kennedy, the father, was the ambassador to the UK during the war. He's already been in. Like, his whole family's in government. Yeah. They know who Kennedy is. This is annoying me. Mm. Also, his father was crooked and a Nazi.
Just touring through history like an incredibly boring Bill and Ted.
Yeah, like a sort of greatest hits beat. Before he faces the press about his failed campaign for whatever, Secretary of Commerce, it turns out, Robert Downey Jr. says that Oppenheimer was always against him, right back to when he turned Einstein against him. Robert Downey Jr.'s aide says that maybe Oppenheimer and Einstein were talking about something else. We learn that Oppenheimer has said to Einstein that they may have started a chain reaction that will end the world, which leads a pensive Einstein to ignore Robert Downey Jr. and snub him. The end. Shite.
Hey, well done.
That's not too.
Thank you for condensing that so much.
I'd largely sort of stopped paying attention.
We paused it and we were like, how is there another hour to go? Yeah. Because at that point they'd already detonated the bomb and everything like that. That main thrust of what felt like the story was done. And we still had another hour to go. Okay, brilliant. Thank you for that synopsis.
Because, I mean, first of all, like, my big criticism, what is this about? And
hold your fucking horses, it's my bit.
Hang on, I just want to get this in ahead of time. Because there's an old Woody Allen joke about, I like sex with kids. No, sorry, he says that I took a speed reading course and I read War and Peace in half an hour. It's about Russia. And this is one of those where it's like, what's this film about? Oh, it's about Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
It's not about anything, it's just, you know?
No, Luke, it's in one of my numbered bullet points.
I'm sorry, get your bullet points out. I will wind my neck in.
Okay, now the actual format that we have for this podcast, Luke, you may have forgotten, is
I'm an improviser. You got a yes and me, bro.
Things that we like. Okay, things we liked was yesterday we watched a different film called American Fiction that was really brilliant. Great. Yeah. That was great. That's something that I like. Yeah. Okay. Oh, okay. Things I like about this
movie. There was a new series of Girls Five Ever. That was
fantastic. Yeah. All right. For this movie, Cillian Murphy does a good job. I think it's fair that he was nominated. I think that. But Cillian Murphy always does a good job. I've never seen Cillian Murphy be bad in anything that I've ever seen him in. He's extremely versatile, talented, brilliant actor. So, yes, he does do a good job.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that is... he's good casting for this is because he has a certain like physical, but also it feels like it transcends it, the fragility. He feels like quite a fragile presence, and that feels like it gives you kind of sympathy for this character who's kind of a bit of a monster and has a lot of incredibly unlikable traits. And I think that Cillian Murphy's presence kind of humanizes him quite a lot.
But to push back on that a little bit, because There's a Bruce Springsteen line about, we learn more from a 3-minute record, baby, than we ever learned in school. I learned more from a 10-minute Wikipedia on Robert Oppenheimer than I did from this three, you know.
Oh, I know. I'm just scraping desperately to find things to say that are good.
What a lot of people said about Oppenheimer was that he was really personally magnetic. He was like awkward in big social situations, but in one-to-one, he was really sort of drew people in and really, really charming. And it's interesting that when Christopher Nolan made The Prestige, which is also not a very good film, he wants to cast Nikola Tesla and he casts David Bowie. And I think like a Bowie-esque figure would be interesting as Oppenheimer, would be more accurate. I don't think he should be as delicate as Cillian Murphy is. Yeah, I think he should be more overawing.
And I'm going into this saying that I have done no further research on the Manhattan Project or The Real Thing. Yeah. So I don't know. So I think some of the cast do some good stuff. I think Matt Damon, like you said, immediately puts a boot in the ass of the whole movie and is a really strong presence. He feels like an anchor.
Yeah.
Like, I'm pleased whenever he's there because I suddenly feel like I'm in good hands.
Yeah, something will be happening here.
Which is, you know, partly the character, really. It was nice to see Josh Hartnett again.
Yeah.
Do you know how I felt? I felt like, this happened to me once, there was a boy that I was in school with who was, like, in my English class, and we always got on fine, and then I hadn't seen him for years, and bumped into him once in town about 10 years later, and I was like, oh, it's nice to see you.
Yeah, I think we all feel that way about Josh Hartnett.
You look well. Yeah. And then I left again. And
Hartnett has aged well, actually. Looks good. Yeah.
Josh Hartnett looks well. And I was like, oh, nice to see you, Josh Hartnett. Yeah. Well done. And I think he did a good job.
Yeah.
So that's the things that I could find that I liked. So I've tried to break down. So point one is, fuck me, this is boring.
Yeah.
Okay. But the point of this podcast is that we are like deconstructing things from a like structural point of view and stuff to work
why
out
doesn't
why.
This work
why is it
work?
So boring? Yeah. Okay. So I think that a huge amount of the reason why it's boring, which we've already touched on, is because of the story structure, is because for the first 47 minutes, we don't have any proper compelling, we don't have a hugely compelling character because we don't really understand him. And we also have nothing that we're following because we don't, it doesn't explain to us. We meet him and he's in this sort of court, but it's not a court because it's just in a room. And one of the first things they say is he says, Your Honour, and they're like, we don't have to say Your Honour.
Yeah, officially, not that it's ever spelled out for the audience, this was a hearing about his security clearance as part of the Atomic Energy
Division.
We don't find that out until the end. Yeah.
So as the audience, we're just in this weird interview that we don't understand what the stakes or the consequences are. So is he going to go to prison? Is he going to be executed? Is he going to be exiled to Russia? I don't know. I don't know what's happening. And it stays like that. Then we go into this black and white timeline with Robert Downey Jr. They're all speaking quite fast and it's incredibly dialogue based and you have to be following it. And I got more out of it the second time round as I was following it. But it just doesn't, basically, it doesn't help you in any way, shape or form. And what is happening is not particularly compelling or coherent. And 47 minutes in, that is wearing as fuck. It is wearing after 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So
we both flagged this. You need to know this story before you can watch this film and get anything out of it, which is not how telling a story is supposed to work, you guys.
Yeah. And then as the story, so I've tried to actually kind of break this down critically. As the story progresses, what we have is, okay, so I might have mentioned this before on the podcast, but there is something that you talk about when you're making stories called good confusion and bad confusion.
Yeah.
So what you want in a story is you want good confusion, which is where you haven't spoon-fed the audience every single little bit of information that they need to know. You withhold a little bit. And then what this does is it makes the audience active because they have to slightly work to keep up with the story. So what is pleasurable as an audience is when you're sitting there and you're slightly piecing things together, you're making up a little jigsaw puzzle in your head of like, oh, okay, oh, that she's being moody. And then we find out it's because he had an affair.
Yeah,
and then we like understand what this is.
Yeah, you're
and
leaving breadcrumbs for people.
Yeah. Now, that is called good confusion. That is nice.
Yeah.
What you don't want is bad confusion, which is obviously the opposite. It's just, and you get bad confusion in one of two ways, either because you have got far too much information. You've been given so much information. So imagine you meet a character, you're given their whole biography. You've got no idea what is important. You've just been told everything and you can't parse out what do I need to understand the story? So it can either be bad because you've got too much information or bad because you have not enough. You don't actually understand what's going on at all because you haven't been given either. This film does both.
Yeah.
So at the beginning, we have far too much information, but also not nearly enough.
Yeah.
I have no way of navigating as an audience member what is important information that I need to keep hold of. And I'm being fired so much of it that I just can't fucking navigate.
Yeah. Sometimes it really just like, it's like drinking out of a fire hose, and other times you're just lost, and there's no real, and it seems to be like AB, there doesn't seem to be a good middle ground that it ever quite hits.
Exactly, yeah. And there's like, it's like an irritable bowel of a story.
Yes. Yeah.
And then, so when we finally get into this bit where we feel like, oh, thank God, right, they're in Los Alamos, there's a group of people trying to achieve a goal.
Yeah.
Then loads of stuff clips by incredibly too fast. Yeah. Like, I was doodling and I for 5 minutes and I completely lost. So yeah. I was listening, but I wasn't watching.
Yeah.
And I totally lost track of what the fuck was going on.
Yeah.
So it just, I think fundamentally the biggest thing is the structure. And then, as you've said, I think my point too is that it focuses on the wrong things, right? Mm. So it's taken this big, huge sort of swathe of history. It's taken this big event, but then it's also taken events before and after that event.
Yeah.
So it's doing far too much. And like, what is the through line? Why is it selected these bits of this story to tell us?
Yeah, it's not saying anything about any of this.
No.
And there's so much that you could do with this, yeah. which I'll get to. I've got a lot of fixes here. But.
So what we are given is the framing device of not one, but two trials. So the thing
that they're not trials.
Yeah. So what is kind of holding the story is that Cillian Murphy is kind of reporting his life. And the reason that we have these flashbacks is because he's explaining his life to this committee that we don't fully understand until the end. But then we're intercutting that with Robert Downey Jr., who's talking about the trial that Cillian Murphy, we find out he orchestrated for Cillian Murphy. But we don't really understand.
In order that Robert Downey Jr., Admiral Strauss, can become Secretary of Commerce, which, real stakes that were, never mind that we had an atom bomb being invented in this. The real stakes are apparently, does this guy get to be the Secretary of Commerce
exactly.
in 1960?
Exactly this. So towards the end of the film, after we've already detonated the bomb, they've dropped it on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and we haven't really dealt with the consequences of that in any way. Then the whole of the rest of the plot, which is like an hour, becomes about us. We're supposed to care. We're supposed to understand that Robert Downey Jr. has orchestrated this in order to attack Cillian Murphy, which they really don't reveal until right at the end. And then Robert Downey Jr. becomes the bad guy of the story. Yeah. And we're supposed to care about him being defeated. And that Oppenheimer is this weird kind of hero martyr thing. But one, I don't give a shit about Robert Downey Jr. at any point.
No.
Two.
In life or in the movie.
Yeah. And also, as I said to you, if you want to tell me that this character's an asshole, you already did. You cast Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, it's really easy.
I understood that the second he appeared on screen.
Yeah. Smarmy, manipulative twat.
Yeah, exactly. Then, so why am I suddenly caring about him? Why? And then I can't swing to caring hugely about what happens to Oppenheimer because I don't actually even know what the outcome of this thing is. He's not going to be murdered if he's like executed or put in prison. And then also what it does is it reduces this huge, huge atrocity that happened in humankind to a dick-swinging contest about Robert Downey Jr. and this other man. And I'm like, really? Is this the most important thing, Christopher Nolan?
And not only that, but I've said here, like, it reduces all of McCarthyism to, a few bad apples. It's not that McCarthyism was a bad thing and that America was really paranoid about communists to its own detriment. It's that, it was just like Robert Downey Jr. and a few other people were a bit, but they got what they deserved and everything's fine. It's like, we're kind of ignoring, like say, another huge sway of the history there, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's got this very ambivalent tone about the bomb and about his reasons for doing it and stuff. Yeah. And that is interesting, right? If you think that the reason that you are building this huge weapon of mass destruction, and they say this a few times, is because it's for peace.
Yeah.
But and there's a bit where there's a debate going on where the Los Alamos scientists are behind Robert Oppenheimer's back, seem to be having a conversation about, should we be continuing? Is this... Now, for me, that is incredibly interesting, but it's just sort of one facet. And then it reduces it down into this weird trial and makes it about Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah. Who cares?
It's such a baffling sideways move for me. Yeah. Like, why are we doing this? Okay. I've got a few more points.
Just as long as we're exploring some of the, this could have been more interesting stuff. Oppenheimer had worked, I can't remember what the guy's name was. He had some, was it Pauly? He'd done some like pretty important work earlier on about chemical bonds and such with a guy. And then Oppenheimer tried to fuck his wife. Because Oppenheimer tried to fuck everybody's wife.
Right? Yeah.
And then they had a falling out and they didn't work together again. But then Oppenheimer tried to hire him for the Manhattan Project a few years later. And he said, I can't do it, I'm a pacifist.
Yeah.
So it's not, so again, like there is debate within the scientific community about whether this is right and proper or not, and like you say, this should be one of the fundamental focuses of the film is if we don't build the bomb, the Nazis could build the bomb.
Yeah.
And that's much worse.
Yeah.
So we have to beat them to the punch.
Yeah.
But that's the meat of this, right?
Yeah. And also, to what extent is one person, even if that person is the figurehead, culpable or responsible for then what happens? Yeah. You know, I think it's interesting you bring up the fair. So that's my point three of things that I hated about this movie, is the treatment of the female characters.
Emily Blunt is in this. That's all I can tell you about her.
Yeah, Emily Blunt is in this. Florence Pugh is naked nearly the whole time that she's on screen. Yeah. These two female characters, so his wife and his mistress, are hideously underdeveloped as characters. And it really, really feels like the only reason there is this much nudity and these kind of sex scenes with Florence Pugh is purely because it's the rest of it is just men in suits talking.
Yeah, it's really just to check the audience is still awake.
Yeah, it really feels like that. And there's a particularly gratuitous bit where he is recounting his affair with her in the committee, and then they appear naked having sex in a room full of clothed people.
Yeah.
Like, and she's kind of, Florence Pugh is having sex with Cillian Murphy while staring at Emily Blunt, which it could be an interesting scene, right? But there is nothing else in the movie about the tension between his mistress and his wife.
Yeah.
And his, and also, like you say, so all the things you've told me about Oppenheimer since, like, from your research have been more interesting than everything that was in the movie. Yeah. And even if you're going to show an affair and you're going to put that part of his life in, which is completely fair enough to do as a historical character, it's the wrong affair to show.
Yeah.
Because like you said, he's having sex with people's wives in Los Alamos, in this confined place, under a lot of pressure.
When he took the job for Robert Downey Jr. in the scene where they meet Einstein, one of the reasons he was ambivalent about taking that job is that he'd have to move away and stop fucking somebody's wife he was fucking in his current job.
Yeah.
It's a real like life thing that he does.
So even from a drama point of view, the much more interesting affairs that he is having is on Los Alamos with those other people, because it has consequences. If you have to work with someone and you're already at a point of disagreement, or you need them, whatever, as a colleague, but you're fucking their wife, that's inherently a dramatic proposition.
I don't know, you can't libel the dead, certainly in the UK, so we'll see whatever we liked about him. But I don't know if he was fucking everybody's wife at Los Alamos, but he's definitely fucking every university he worked at, he was fucking somebody's wife. So he probably was, I think.
But the point is, Florence Pugh is pretty disconnected from the rest of the narrative. So
it's only important because she's a communist.
It's important because she's a communist, and that's it. But his brother's a communist too.
Yeah, yeah.
And he goes to communist meetings. So, and he tries to unionise the department. So
we're not saying he was fucking his brother, by the way. But you can't libel the dead, so yes, he was.
What I'm saying is, not only is it completely gratuitous, it's not even the correct affair to focus on.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like. So it just is hideous, and it feels like a total waste of those two really, really brilliant actors. And
if you're going to focus on the fact that Oppenheimer had a lot of affairs with people, it speaks to his selfishness, right? That he was only interested in what he wanted personally at any given time and was blind to other things. And then it's like, right, well, that's interesting when you create a doomsday device, right?
Yeah.
You were interested to see whether you could do this for your own personal benefit, maybe. And maybe that speaks to character, maybe. You know?
Exactly. It seems to not thematically tie in at all. So even when he gets news of her suicide and he is like, Emily Blunt finds him sort of crying in the woods, it doesn't, That for me, unless I've missed something, which I may have, because God, I was bored and it's confusing, that doesn't lead to anything, right?
Yeah.
So it's this thing that a plot should be causal. Interestingly, a chain reaction, like you get in an atomic device, where everything builds and connects to the next thing, and it's like a series of dominoes. But that, for me, even that, her death doesn't really make any difference to the plot.
Yeah.
Like, why is it there? Why is she there? Okay, just really, really briefly, the other things. The soundtrack did my head in.
Music by Ludwig Göransson, I checked.
Oh my God.
A movie soundtrack is a little bit like a football referee, right? There's this thing in sports that, like, as a referee, if you're doing your job well, nobody notices.
Yep.
It's only when you fuck it up you get a lot of attention. And I feel like that was the case with this soundtrack. Like, a good soundtrack, it just adds to the whole mix.
100%.
Whereas this one is just like, it's distractingly bad.
You shouldn't notice the soundtrack.
Yeah.
You should only notice the soundtrack if it's like, like, you know, often sometimes in a really heightened bit, the score is really swelling and you feel yourself beginning to well up because you're being carried by the music.
Yeah.
And it's so you sort of notice, you become conscious of it, but in a kind of pleasurable way, right?
Yeah.
Because it's enhancing what you're watching. Whereas this is incredibly distracting. It is, not only does it sort of pull against the movie, it pulls because a lot of what we're listening to feels like kind of electronica, which isn't from the era. So you're immediately like, oh, this is odd because this music doesn't go with this image that I'm looking at. But also, it kind of poundingly, insistently goes, this is important, this is important, this is important,
and
this
you said
is important.
It's playing, as Spinal Tap said, it's playing at 10 all the time.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It comes in at 10.
Well, it's at 11.
Well, yeah, but they can go to 11.
They can go to 11.
Yeah, most people can only play at 10. Yeah, but that's the thing. There's never any sort of subtle stuff going on. It's just constantly trying to force drama into scenes that are very flat by loudly playing drama music at you.
It's exactly that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's 100% that. It feels incongruous. It's distracting. It becomes irritating all the way through. The dialogue is incredibly mannered. You get these things. People don't talk like people talk. Even like,
they also don't do the thing that I was hoping for, where they talk like the 50s. See, and everyone begins a sentence with "well" and stretches their braces out, which is what I love.
They're obviously incredibly, like, we're talking about genius level characters for the most part. I expect them to have erudite, sophisticated conversation.
It's sophisticated.
But like also just the dialogue that is like between people relationally of like flirting or whatever is also not how anyone talks.
Oh, it's really clunky.
So clunky.
Florence Pugh breaks off in the middle of sex to go and inspect his bookshelf to see what he's reading, which nobody has ever done in the history of anything. And then she opens the Bhagavad Gita, which he's reading in Sanskrit, which apparently he did do. To the crucial part about now I'm become death, the destroyer of worlds.
Out of any page she could have opened.
Yeah. Oh, what are the odds? It's like, it's just so
it's
badly
like
scripted.
That. It feels like everything is going, here is an important line.
Yeah.
And then the music's going, this is important.
Pay attention to this bit. Oh, Christ. Yeah.
And finally, the uses montage, particularly at the beginning. So splicing together kind of disconnected images. We get like sort of raindrops and sort of abstract things that are either kind of bomb explosions or bits of kind of visions of nuclear fusion and fission
and
stuff like that.
But
it's really badly done. One thing I did expect from this movie is I expected it to look beautiful. I thought I was going to be swept away. It's a huge budget. It's an incredibly esteemed director whose work I've previously enjoyed. I thought it would at least be sumptuous. I thought it would look amazing.
In an aesthetically beautiful period as well.
It doesn't look beautiful at all for the most part. It looks really mundane.
I think after Don't Worry Darling, the lesson for this entire show is don't watch things set in the New Mexico desert with Florence Pugh, right? which did look fantastic but also suck.
But that looked good.
Yeah, like I like the desert, I like Florence Pugh. If they're both in it, I'm out. I'm not doing it anymore.
But this didn't look good, and what particularly didn't look good was the montage, which just seemed like if you had told me this was made by someone's A-level project, I would have believed you.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
It's clunky, it doesn't flow together, and what it made me think of was when we watched Elvis by Baz Luhrmann, there's a lot about that film that I didn't enjoy, but I did think the montage was spectacular. The way he layers images and the way he edits and he rapidly cuts and the colours and the composition of it, it's like looking at a series of like incredible pop art being directed, like injected into your eyeballs.
So Luhrmann can do spectacle, and so can Christopher Nolan normally.
Why was the spectacle so poor? So that was absolutely rubbish. Before we move on to fix this, Luke, I'm going to suggest that we have a short intermission. Okay, we're back. I'm sorry if we sound a bit aggy. It's because we both found this so frustrating.
Yes, yeah.
And so, like, what a waste of everyone's fucking time.
Yeah. do you have any fixes?
I have things to talk about.
Okay, I have fixes. So
okay, all right.
And I got this. I think there's three different directions you could go with the material available to you.
Okay, great.
So, option number one is that you make this a project about the Manhattan Project rather than about Oppenheimer personally.
Yes, right? Like an ensemble drama.
Yeah. Well, not even necessarily a drama. The way I thought of it was you should do this like Catch 22, Joseph Heller's novel, which is also about World War II. Somebody recently said on Twitter that Masters of the Sky is in the same universe as Band of Brothers, and people were like, what, World War II? So the expanded Band of Brothers universe, or the Second World War, as we're calling it. Catch-22 was also set in that universe. Where Catch-22 sort of starts off being comedic, but gets darker as it goes, because that's kind of the point. That the war like was ridiculous in its way, but was also very, very serious. So you do the sort of getting the band together and stuff. You explain who all these physicists are, because they're all interesting characters in their own right.
Such interesting characters.
And then, like, some of it is ludicrous. Richard Feynman, like I say, who is in this, wrote several memoirs later in life. Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman. And I can't remember what the other one was off the top of my head. I've read them both. But it was a long time ago. But he said that, like, he found a hole in the fence at the Manhattan Project, and then for a while he was, like, signing himself out of the gate because security was really tight, running around the corner, going back through the hole, then signing himself out again and trying to see how many times he could do that before he got caught. And then, like, he took up lockpicking as a hobby for a while, and then, like, Leslie Groves was like, why are you breaking into that safe? He's like, oh, I do it to all of them. Like, well, stop fucking doing that. Everything in there is classifying. He's like, just dicking about. Well, yeah, exactly. You know, you can sort of picture Leslie Groves, Oppenheimer! You know? You could do it that way. And then, and this is a big note that I've got here in capital letters anyway, show the fucking bombing of Hiroshima. Yeah. Because it turns out that this is all fun and games, and it is an interesting intellectual game to play, right? And you can even have them like, oh, why are you guys treating this like a game? You go, well, the inventor of game theory is three doors down. He's discussing aliens with Enrico Fermi right now, you know. It's a fun project to work on to try to, like, make new physics, and these are interesting and fun characters.
They were there for years, right?
They were there for several years, and then they committed an atrocity.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And you have to reckon with the weight of that, and yes. Then you get a second half about how do you then proceed. Right? Because, like, last podcast on the left did a series about the atomic bombings in preparation for this movie coming out. And the stories from Hiroshima and Nagasaki are harrowing. You know? Like people that weren't instantly vaporized, like, there was so much soot and stuff, like, blown into the air that it rained black shortly afterwards.
Yeah.
So then you've got, like, this blasted landscape where, like, people are just stumbling around burned and blind and dying with their skin hanging off.
A war that was basically over.
And it starts, like, raining tar on these, like, zombies that are staggering around in rags. It's like, this is, like, the horror show that they created. And like you say, the war is basically over, and there's this whole debate, which is interesting and should be mined, about were the Japanese willing to fight to the last man? Like, could America, because you have to sort of island hop your way up to Japan through the Pacific, and the Japanese, like, they were going to defend every island to the death. And is it better to just, like, drop one giant bomb and say, look, stop fucking around, we're not doing it this way, because it would ultimately save lives? But I think the key point there is that even if you are doing a long, grinding out campaign through the islands, the lives that you are losing there are active combatants. They are soldiers. You are not bombing a civilian population and melting them to death, right?
We don't ever get what the international community thought of it, what the average American
thought. We don't even see any of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in this movie, which is it's a fucking crime, right?
Yeah.
It's insulting to everyone involved in that. And
we watch Cillian Murphy's face as he refuses to look at news footage of it.
Yes.
That's it. That's
which is what this movie is also doing. And it's a fucking obscenity. Yeah. There was a story, to make this a little bleak for a minute, but there was a story in the last podcast episode where they said there were some children that stayed home. They'd been in their house and, like, survived the worst of the blast. And when they finally sort of got the nerve to open the door, this thing crawled in, sort of howling. And they thought maybe it was a dog or something that had been burned. And eventually they realized it was their mother.
Oh, my God.
Who had crawled home to die and was no longer recognizable as human. And it's like, and you did that to people. That is what you did if you worked on this project. Right?
But how did Robert Downey Jr. feel about
it? Yeah. Did he ever get to be Secretary of Commerce? Yeah.
Did he ever get to be Secretary of Commerce? Yeah.
That's the fucking horror that you have unleashed by doing this. And we're not even really acknowledging it in the film. You know?
Yeah.
So, a bit dark for a second there.
That's okay. Yeah. You're right. You've teared up. Luke's teared up talking about
Oppenheimer.
That.
I hardly know her. Waka waka. Hong Kong. We're back in. You know. So first of all, show what the consequences were. The main consequence of Oppenheimer's life, if this is about Oppenheimer, or if it's about the Manhattan Project, show what it led to.
Yeah, because I actually don't know, even from this biopic, which is what this is, I don't really know how he felt about it.
No, exactly. So, second way that we can approach this is you dig into Oppenheimer's interest in Hinduism, right?
Mm.
And the Florence Pugh thing about, like, because he's famously said, he didn't say it out loud, it's kind of an urban legend, when the Trinity test went off, when the first bomb was detonated and it worked, his thought was, he said, now I'm become death, the destroyer of worlds, which is a line from the Bhagavad Gita. But because this film is so fucking superficial, it doesn't dig into that. It just has Florence Pugh bring that up
with her boobs out. Yeah.
The point of that scene within the Bhagavad Gita is that Prince Arjuna is possibly having to go to war with his relatives, and he's not sure as to whether he should be doing his duty as a warrior or whether it is morally wrong to attack his people that are related to it, which is a key theme to do you build the bomb or not, right? That ties in very, very nicely with it. And Lord Krishna, like, reveals his true form to him and says, I'm become death, and becomes this sort of multi-limbed, terrifying creature.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I'm become death, the destroyer of worlds. Like, the point being, I'm told, within the Bhagavad Gita is that it's not up to you as an individual warrior whether people die or not. God chooses this, and you are just the instrument of it.
Mm.
All of which is very interesting. And not dug into anywhere.
Yeah,
because that's because you know, Oppenheimer was interested in this stuff, so he would have understood that. He wasn't thinking about that personally. It's not that Arjuna becomes death, it's that Krishna does, because Krishna is already a deity. So it's not that he's thinking that he is death, he's thinking that the bomb has become death and has revealed the true form of death to him, right? That's probably what he was thinking when he was looking at that, if you've read the text. Which is, I think,
so it is not a disinteresting subject.
No, there's so much you could mind.
It's such an interesting subject. So right? Why does it take 3 hours to be so boring? Yeah.
And once again, like, a lot of people that knew Oppenheimer said he was an odd mix of, like, he was very naive in some respects. And it's this thing, like, he knew, I think it is correct that you had to beat the Germans to the bomb. But if you were structuring this well dramatically, one of the key things is that when the war ends, the Germans had nothing.
Yeah.
They were years off. They'd fucked it. And Oppenheimer even acknowledges this in one of the few good scenes with Matt Damon, where he says, the best weapon that America has is anti-Semitism, because all the great physicists in Germany were all Jewish. Yeah. They were all exiled. So the German bomb effort is stalling because they haven't got the right guys to work with anymore.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But I think that's the kick in the teeth, is that once you've built this bomb, once you've unleashed this fucking thing on the world, you find out that you didn't need to do it because Germany was beaten militarily.
Yeah, yeah.
There was no need to beat them to the bomb because they didn't have it.
Another interesting thing.
Another interesting idea that we could have used here, right? You know? So there's that. So like I say, you dig into the Hinduism and then you get into that...
what you're talking about, though, is the internality of the character of Oppenheimer, which is what this promises you, because we are ostensibly being told his life story. We go back to when he was a student. We follow him to when he's a really old man. And still, I don't feel like I really understood him. Not even that he's really complex and he's difficult to get a handle on. No, just that we don't ever properly dig into him.
But then, like I say, you get that true detective thing of time is a flat circle, which is a big concept in Hinduism, right? This idea that his whole life is like going around in this circle. And interestingly, he was from a wealthy family. He was sent to a private school, which is an ethical culture society school, whose motto was deed before creed. Because the whole point is, it's not what you profess to believe, it's about what you do. That's how you do fucking foreshadowing movie, is that you do time going round on itself, is that when he was a kid, he was educated under a big sign that said, it doesn't matter what you believe, it's what you do.
Yeah.
And then again, this is my third way that you approach this, is you dissect the American ego. Americans hate fucking doing this. They don't like looking at themselves at the best of times. But you dissect the American ego, because the thing is, he created a doomsday device and they loved him for it, but then they slated him for having known some communists. It was all about what he professed to believe, not about what he actually did, and what he did was possibly end the world, right? And that's interesting. Why aren't we looking at this?
But did Robert Downey Jr. get made?
This is because you fucking know, right? Is that you just get rid of Robert Downey Jr.
Oh my god. 100% cut it.
Or have him play somebody else, right? And then this
completely
is my other...
Completely fucking cut that whole plotline. Yeah. I don't care.
Yeah.
And like you say, it's insulting that it's in this story.
Yeah.
That this is what... Are you out of everything that there is to talk about? This is what we spend so much time with.
Because again, if you want to like dissect McCarthyism, you should have John von Neumann, who worked on the Manhattan Project and was largely regarded as the smartest guy in the room on the Manhattan Project, even by all the people that worked there, which is, again, interesting character. And Edward Teller, who does crop up in this as a sort of semi-antagonist, but not really properly. Von Neumann had lost family to the communists in Hungary during the communist purge. So he was rabidly anti-communist and very pro-war with Russia, right? And Edward Teller became obsessed with the idea that they could build a better, bigger bomb in the form of the hydrogen bomb, which does come up as a plot point in this movie. And then spent the rest of his career like trying to argue for bigger bombs. So make those two the bad guys. Have Downey Jr. play one of them. I don't fucking care. But like that should, because after the war, Oppenheimer starts arguing that like, okay, nobody should really have this. We did it this one time and we're done now, right, guys? And it's like, no, we're not. This is going, and he's constantly trying to spend all his time trying to prevent an arms race with Russia, which he could see coming. Like, if we've got it, they're going to want it. They're going to build a bigger one. So are we. We need to stop this from happening. And of course he couldn't, right?
Mm.
Because again, he was in some ways very naive. Like he built this one time bomb. And as soon as it's real, you realise the consequences of it and that you've let it out of the bottle and you can't put it back in, right? Which is should be what this film's about.
I know. All of those.
Yeah.
Fantastically more interesting than anything that we've
like given. So you dissect the American ego, because if you're going to do the plot line that Robert Downey Jr.'s character is ultimately a petty person who's more obsessed with being slighted as he perceives it than with anything that's actually going on, that is an interesting metaphor for the Cold War, right? Is that a lot of Americans hated Russia, not for political reasons, but just because Russia was a challenge to American hegemony and they were upset about it.
Mm.
It's like they didn't like there being another big power player.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So it becomes about a pissing contest again, which it kind of was. And maybe you make Downey Jr.'s character an analogue for the American ego in that respect. And that's an interesting way to do it. Again, so many different fucking ways you can make a good film out of this.
The thing is, The thing, it's not just that it's focusing on the wrong thing. It actually doesn't properly focus on anything,
which is part
of the problem. Because the biggest challenge of a biopic is that you have to be, people's lives aren't like stories, no, because stories have endings, yeah, and stories have like, have, they make sense, right? A good story is coherently a thing where everything is building and making sense, but people's lives, our lives, the reason we need stories is because life is fucking random, yeah, and stuff just carries on and then it comes back and it's episodic and it sort of goes all over the place. This is the big challenge of the pull between the content and the form when you're trying to make a biopic out of someone's life. Now, the intelligent ones either pick an incredibly short period of someone's life and use that as a way to explore them as a character,
yeah,
or you have to impose a narrative arc that isn't naturally there,
yeah,
but you make a choice of like, okay, I think that this person's life, I'm going to say that it's about this pull. So like, even though I think Elvis was messy as a movie, as a biopic, it focused on the pull between him and Colonel Tom, yeah, right? So it picked a fucking through line.
Yeah.
And this movie just doesn't pick a proper through line, and I think it's because it thinks it can do everything,
yeah,
and then what it does focus on feels completely irrelevant.
Yeah, I mean, what it's briefly touched on at the end of this film, because this film eventually does end,
that's my favorite bit,
yeah, but in the early 60s, not long before he died, Oppenheimer was given the Enrico Fermi Award, and he was presented with it by the president as a sort of political rehabilitation of him,
yeah,
because like, he was denied his security clearance in the 50s based on Robert Downey Jr.'s, yeah, machinations, which was seen as like a bit of a kick in the teeth for him.
That is the most important thing that happened in his life.
Yeah.
When his security clearance got denied.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, shit.
But that's the thing.
I hope like, his library card was all right.
If you're giving him the Enrico Fermi Award to say that like they're sort of forgiving him a bit, what America seems to believe about Oppenheimer is that whilst what he believed may have been questionable, what he did was good.
Mm.
And in actual fact, there was nothing really wrong with what he believed. What he did may have been monstrous, right?
Yeah.
And then we circle back to his early life in Hinduism,
know,
like times of flat circle.
D
before Creed. It's like fucking such an easy way to do this.
I think those are masterful. Shall I get onto what I had,
yeah, go for
this?
Yeah.
Okay, so usually my job as a script doctor, so in real life, but also on this podcast, is to try and understand, it isn't to say what I think that it should be in terms of, I believe that this is the story you should be telling. My job is to go, what is the story you are trying to tell and how can I help you more effectively tell it?
Yeah.
And usually with a movie, we can see what they are trying to do and the ways in which they failed.
Yeah.
So for example, to bring you back to the halcyon days of Tom Cruise's The Mummy.
Yes, yes.
Which we watched back when
we've all seen.
Back when I was still drinking.
Largely because of Tom Cruise's
The
Mummy.
Yeah, I mean, I needed that. But we could see what it was trying to do, right? He was trying to be funny. He,
yeah,
was trying to make this bit scary. But we could understand by deconstructing how it was made and various, yeah, factors like the casting, why this bit wasn't scary and that bit wasn't funny.
Yeah.
The issue with Oppenheimer, and the reason I'm saying this, is because I think this is 100% the film Christopher Nolan wanted to make. I, yeah, have no doubt that he has failed to do the thing he wants to do.
Yeah.
I think he was wrong about, yeah, what he wanted to do. So he, you know, he wrote the movie, he directed the movie, he produced it with his wife.
Yeah.
He had a huge, like almost total control, yeah, about what he did with,
yeah,
this movie.
He's Christopher Nolan in 2023. He can do what he likes.
He can do whatever he likes.
Yeah.
And that is what I think the problem is.
Yeah. Very often is.
So I listened to the BAFTA podcast with him. It's quite an interesting podcast. If you're interested in the movies that were nominated for the BAFTA, they speak to the people that made them. And when he's talking about this movie, what he talks about is that he was interested in the moment where they are deciding whether or not they might blow up the atmosphere and whether they should,
yeah,
do it, which he's right, is a really fascinating dramatic proposition,
yeah,
to which is one part of this film. But mostly what he talks about is the cultural event, both of this is a big cultural event that happened and I want to make a movie that is a cultural event.
Yeah.
And he talks about that he agreed to do it for less money if he could have a huge marketing budget because,
yeah,
he wanted the film to be as big. And fundamentally what he doesn't talk about in his interest in this story is the characters or a theme,
yeah,
or the story.
Yeah.
He talks about it as it's a big important thing, brackets, I'm a big important director,
yeah, I'm doing a big important thing,
I'm gonna make,
yeah,
a big important movie. And that's what I mean. I think they got a huge boost from Barbie. I think if it hadn't been Barbieheimer, this wouldn't have,
yeah,
been, like, grossed.
The
it's,
fact that
it,
this got loads of Oscars
well.
And that Margot Robbie was snubbed is a fucking tragedy.
It,
and
yeah.
You cannot help but assume that that was sexism in that play. Think so. Because I think they're trying to put Margot Robbie back in her box like they do in the movie. I think.
I 100% think that. Interestingly, Margot Robbie's, the other big film that she made that was a huge cultural event was she was a producer on Saltburn.
Yeah.
Which, regardless of what you think about it, dominated the cultural landscape for the second half of last year after Barbie did.
Yeah.
So Margot Robbie ruled 2023.
She got nothing for it.
Yeah, and she got very, very little reward. And I think that that was, like you say, they're trying to put her back in her box. So in the absence of being able to help Nolan with what he wants, because I think he's 100% done what he wanted to do, which was to wallow around in this, talk about all sorts of different things, be perceived as very clever.
But I said to you at the time, if you want to do a story about, you know, potentially setting the atmosphere on fire, like the fact that man's hubris and the fact that we always pursue things whether or not it's a good idea, that's Jurassic Park.
Like,
and that's
exactly.
Cat's Cradle, the Kurt Vonnegut novel, which is also, which is Vonnegut's take on the bomb.
Essentially, the only way that we really understand, as human beings, that we understand the scale of a thing, that it means something to us, is if you root it in a human scale. So what I mean is, if there is a huge war or something, it is very difficult to kind of conceptualize and weep for 10,000 people dying.
But Joseph Stalin said that one death is a tragedy and a million is a statistic. And he's right.
Well,
because you can't conceive.
And once again, I agree with Stalin.
You're listening to Stalin Cast with B. Roberts.
But in storytelling terms, he's right.
Yeah.
We relate to stories on a human level. And so what you need to do is to bring this down to a human level. And this movie seems to kind of both want to do that, but also not be interested in doing that.
It's not interested in the humans that it's looking at.
No.
And they are interesting humans.
And they are interesting humans. Okay. The thing that it made me think of, and this is my final point, I kept wishing I was watching Chernobyl.
We mentioned that. That's such a fucking good series.
So if you want to have a comparison of something that takes, and Chernobyl has a 5-hour runtime, so it's not it's not that much longer than Oppenheimer. It takes a big historic event that we all know some of the outline of, and then it takes us through both the event happening and the aftermath of the event.
Yeah.
The difference is that Chernobyl is one of the best things that has ever been made, and it also explains a lot of complex nuclear physicists.
But by the end of Chernobyl, if you're paying attention, you understand exactly what went wrong with a functioning nuclear reactor and why.
Yeah.
Whereas at the end of this movie, they haven't even shown you the bomb going off.
Yeah. So I think that to pick out some of the reasons, I mean, it's superbly acted and shot and directed and everything as well. Yeah. But to kind of break down in technical terms why I think it's so successful.
Chernobyl
is. So it's a big historical event and it takes it as an ensemble cast, which I think is important because it gives you different perspectives on this thing. So it doesn't just root it in one person. I think that would have been a mistake with Chernobyl. And I think it's probably a mistake with Oppenheimer, unless you're really going to dig into this man's psychology, which it doesn't.
Yeah.
And and what it does is it gives you two incredibly, out of that ensemble, they're all good, but there's two real heartbreaking characters. One is played by Jared Harris, who is the scientist who's kind of our lead character, if there is one, who takes us through. He's drafted in to try and deal with the Chernobyl, try and contain it, and try and stop the aftermath. And then we follow him through into the commission later, where they're kind of reporting it, and he's trying to get the communists to take accountability.
He's trying
for
to get
happened.
The truth out in a system that no longer has truth.
Exactly. Yeah. The other character that is the kind of heart of the show is Jessie Buckley.
Mm.
And her role is, she is married to a firefighter who goes in early on to try and, contain the disaster. He dies horribly through radiation poisoning. She goes in to see him when she is banned from going to see him because she wants to be with her husband as he's dying.
Yeah.
And she's pregnant. And because of that, and she lies about being pregnant and going in, and because of that, their baby is born, you know, with birth defects and dies.
Yeah.
So it immediately, through the story of a couple, tells you in visceral, heartbreaking detail about the human impact of that radiation and what happened to ordinary people who were kind of caught up in it. Those are two fundamental things that this movie could have done. It could have taken us to a family who
were
affected.
You could have shown a Japanese family who were just going about their daily lives.
You could have even had Americans posted overseas or people who were connected.
Fucking Clint Eastwood, who is not the sharpest guy in the world, but is at least a competent filmmaker, did Flags of Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima, which were the two World War II movies that were set on opposite sides of the same battle, one with a Japanese cast, one with an American one, right?
Yeah.
So it's not, like, yeah. everyone, it's like basic fucking moral philosophy is that there are two yeah. sides to every war, guys.
Yeah, exactly. Or you could have even had, and just lied about it, that some, or you could have had somebody else on the Los Alamos who was destroyed by taking part in yeah. this. If it's not Oppenheimer who feels terrible, I'm sure there were other scientists involved. There were huge amounts of people involved in this project that couldn't cope with the moral weight of what they'd contributed
to. This is another note I've got here, because of the whole thing that, like, you know, Krishna says to Arjuna that, like, you're just a soldier and that fate is my decision. Does Oppenheimer believe too much in fate and then believe that nothing is his responsibility? We don't know, because we don't dig into it. Yeah.
So we don't get the human, we don't get the cost and the grounding and the heartbreaking stories that we get yeah. with Chernobyl, which yeah. we fully get. And the other really, really, really key thing that Chernobyl does, which is why it is so successful and coherent and beautifully put together as a piece, is because it has a theme.
Yeah.
It takes this big historical event and it says, right, this is the lens that we are going to look at this event through. And what that is through Jared Harris's character. And he says, these are the opening lines of Chernobyl. What is the cost of lies?
Yeah.
And that is a real speech made by that character. And the Craig Mazin decide to construct the entire series about this idea of truth and lies. If the communists had been honest about what was happening, if they had not tried to fudge the truth, if they had yeah. looked after the reactors properly, then this wouldn't have happened. So this is the cost of a lie, is this atrocity, yeah. is what's happened.
And the fundamental question about the Manhattan Project in general is, yeah, the Nazis were worse. We couldn't let the Nazis have the bomb. And then, you know, for the rest of Oppenheimer's life, he died in 67, I think, for the rest of his life, the Soviets were the bad guys, right? The Soviets were doing terrible things. It would be a bad idea to let Stalin
yeah.
just, you know, to just roll over yeah, for him.
Yeah, also committing genocide.
Yeah, exactly. And but then, and also the Japanese were committing horrendous fucking... They were doing everything yeah. as bad as the Nazis. They didn't do it at the same scale. But so it was important to beat the Japanese and it's important to beat the Nazis.
Yeah.
But what is the cost of that? Again, yeah. how far are you justified in these? That's a basic fucking question well, to yes, ask.
And to bring it back to how we structure stories... What that does is it asks a question. It says, it literally, the first line asks a question, what is the cost of lies? And at the end of it, we find out what the cost of a lie is.
Yeah, so every lie we tell incurs a debt to the truth, and sooner or later that debt comes due. Yeah.
Exactly. So it imposes a structure and a narrative arc. It asks a question and it answers it by the end of it. I will tell you the opening lines of Oppenheimer, which I looked up because I decided to have a look at the screenplay. The opening lines of Oppenheimer are... Burp, burp, burp. Dr. Oppenheimer, as we begin, I believe you have a statement to read for the record.
Uh-huh.
What a powerful opening line that is for Oppenheimer. We then have four more lines of dialogue where he's corrected, and then Oppenheimer begins to read his statement for the record. We could have opened, if we needed to open here, with Oppenheimer reading his statement for the record, where he says, I'm Dr. Oppenheimer, and these are lies that have been told about me, and I'm going to tell you the story of my life. But we don't start there. We start six lines earlier.
Marley was dead to begin with, according to this report from the coroner that he's going to read for us over the next... fucking Christ, here we go. Yeah, start at the fucking Leslie Groves meeting. That's the...
Yeah, but just that tells you about the level of... the level of scrutiny on craft, because what I believe is, I don't think that Christopher Nolan was very heavily noted about this script.
Call me Ishmael or don't, whatever, it's up to you. I here's my birth certificate.
And I think that another scriptwriter who was not Christopher Nolan would have been put under a lot more scrutiny to make this a coherent...
This wouldn't have got anywhere. You said if you just submitted this to a script contest, this wouldn't...
I really don't think it would have got anywhere. I really, really don't. So it's just... But we've done it now.
We've done it.
But it makes me sad, because what I think will happen with this movie, and what's probably happened a lot, is that because it's complicated, because it's weighty and seems very intelligent, a lot of people are going to... And it's won Oscars and has all this buzz. A lot of people will go and see it, not particularly enjoy it, but think that they should have, and it's their fault because they're stupid.
Yeah, it's not. It's just a bad film.
It's not your fault. If you didn't like Oppenheimer... Yeah, I hated it. It's not well made. Yeah, it isn't a very good film.
It's boring and too long and shit. Yeah.
It's boring and too long and shit. It doesn't make sense. It's not even well crafted. The montage is bad. The dialogue is bad. The scene structure is not very good. The soundtrack is interminable.
There's no coherent theme. It doesn't address any of the big issues that it claims to address.
Yeah.
Okay.
To see Josh Hartnett again, though.
Yeah, we enjoyed American Fiction. What was that John Cena, Ricky Stenicki?
Ricky Stenicki, that was good.
Fun. Yeah, a couple of things you've liked lately. I don't know what we're doing next.
We don't know. We're going to find out, so stay tuned.
Stay tuned,
if you
people.
Would like to get in touch with us. We basically just have an email account now, which is...
Yeah.
artsholepodcast@gmail.com if you want to get in touch with us, if you have requests, all those sorts of things.
Yeah.
Say hello.
Yep.
Or you can find me on Instagram. I've changed from Script It because I felt it was maybe not the most professional, even though it was funny.
Yeah. So you can find your boobies now.
I'm Florence Pugh's nips.
On this blessed day, we are all Florence Pugh's nips.
I am B. Roberts Writer on Instagram, if you wish to find me, or you can just Google it.
Yeah.
Come and say hello.
Right.
Thank you for listening.
See ya.